Okay, well, I intended this to be an extremely informal talk, not really a lecture in the proper sense at all. I gave as a provisional title, BEC, I'll tell our guesses, some thoughts on what we do and don't understand. Of course, the pronoun in that is really wrong. We should be I. The question is, what I'll be telling you roughly is what I think I do and don't understand. And I'm sure that many of the things I don't, other people in the audience will, and they can then perhaps supply some of the missing information. But I will try to, as far as I can, to distinguish between areas in which we think we know what to do, as it were, in principle, but it may be highly non-trivial to actually do the calculations or whatever in practice, and areas where we perhaps don't know what we ought to be doing. And in some sense, while I hope both of these activities will go on at the program, I think it's perhaps more important in a program like this that we pay most attention to the second class, that is, where we really are doubtful about conceptual foundations, or maybe doubtful. So let's start off with some really rather basic things. Do we really understand the experimental geometries and experimental techniques which are used to stabilise the Bose condensed alkali gases? My impression is that at least as regards the static magnetic trap or certain kinds of time-dependent trap like the TOP, the top trap, as far as I can see there's no major problem there. As regards the time-dependent, a genuinely time-dependent magnetic trap of a type different from, say, the top trap, which we could make, but as far as I know has not yet been made, I think then life gets a little more complicated. For example, suppose that we have some kind, just imagine that we would have some kind of a quadrupole trap, and arrange, clearly it's going to be asymmetric, it's not spherical, and we arrange to rotate it as a function of time. Then I think there are a lot of rather interesting and non-trivial problems as to how, if at all, equilibrium, thermal equilibrium is established in that rotating trap. And indeed, it's not totally obvious that there's time over the typical time scale of the order of a minute or so, for which most condensates live, there's actually time for equilibrium to be truly established in that kind of situation. So I think that's one thing that perhaps could use some attention. As regards laser traps, as you probably most of you know, the trapping of a Bose condensate by purely laser techniques has been recently reported by the MIT group. And how well do we understand those? Well, I think the tendency has been to simply think of the laser as providing some kind of effective potential by the usual dipole mechanism or whatever. But of course that's not the whole truth. In the first place, we do have to worry, under certain circumstances, we do have to worry about the fact that however far off resonance we tune our laser, we're still going to get some real emission processes. And they may be, you know, make them small by going off resonance, but for certain purposes, particularly when we're worried about subtle coherence effects, we may have to bear that in the back of our minds. A second point is a sort of rather trivial one in a way, but I think is maybe experimentally quite important. Again, it's tempting to think that we just take our atom in the ground state and we shine on our laser tuned somewhere vaguely near the fundamental Rydberg resonance, and what that does basically is shift the energy to the ground state. Well, sure it does, but of course we do have to remember that it's also providing a time-dependent dipole moment in the atom. That dipole moment is then interacting, somewhat non-trivially, with the other dipole moments. And how big is that? Well, I did a very rough back-of-envelope estimate for the recent MIT, the experiment reported in the recent MIT preprint, and it seemed to me, at least, that at essentially nearest neighbour separations, then the electromagnetic interaction energy was in the order of 10 nanoK. Well, okay, 10 nanoK doesn't sound a lot, but you have to remember that you're talking about a long-range force. And so, depending on the shape of the trap and the precise details of the experiment, it seems to me that is something that we might really have to worry about. Okay, having got our system there, do we understand why it stays there or why it disappears? Well, I guess we generally believe that the two-body collisions are relatively unimportant under most circumstances, and the main mechanism is three-body collisions. It seems to me we have a qualitative understanding of that process, but I'm not at all clear, maybe someone can correct me on this, but I'm not really at all clear that in any specific case we really know quantitatively how to calculate the three-body recombination rates, particularly as a function, say, of magnetic field and so forth. One other thing that we have to remember when we're talking about real experiments is that it's almost never the case in a real experiment that the number of particles is constant. As theorists, we in any case tend not to keep the number of particles constant, we tend to keep chemical potential constant. But the question does arise, rather non-trivially in some of these cases I think, is it really legitimate to simply treat, to do thermodynamics in the usual way, keeping the chemical potential either constant or slowly varying function of time, despite the fact that they're continually losing particles by evaporation or recombination, or whatever. Again, I think probably not terribly well explored as a conceptual point. Okay, so now we've got our, let's imagine that we've got our atoms, and for the moment I will assume, from now on I'm going to sort of forget about that point and basically assume that our system is infinitely stable, even though we know in real life it isn't. So we've got our atoms trapped in some reasonably small region of space. Then, of course, the next thing we have to worry about is their interactions. And here I must say I do have a slight problem, and maybe it's not a problem that anyone else has run into, but there is a relation which is very, very frequently quoted in the literature between the effective mean field interaction and the S-wave scattering length. And I know all sorts of hand-waving arguments for that relation, but I've never seen it demonstrated under quite general conditions. And I have a slight thing at the back of my mind that there may be some subtle traps there. I'd be interested if anyone has any comments on that. Okay, so now let's go on to how far we understand the existing experiments, which have actually been done so far. Let me start with the case. Yes, please. Please. I think it's very much better.
Two-body scattering problem.
Yeah.
I think it's sort of Goliath or the old work that diagrammatically.
Yes.
Okay, we'll sum and then we'll sum the T matrix in some way, and we'll go from potential to whatever it was, 4 pi A over M, whatever that scattering length was. You feel that you don't, in fact, in the dilute limit, reduce it to a two-body problem, which you then go away and solve and come back to
I strongly suspect that what is implicit in calculations like that is a formal approximation, which I can make, as it were, at a more Schrödinger equation level, in which I keep the centre of mass of my particles fixed and put spherical boundary conditions on the relative coordinate. And under those conditions, I think there is a relatively simple derivation in terms of the phase shifts and so forth. Under those conditions, you can verify it. Unfortunately, that's not what real life is like. So it's real life I'm worried about. Now, I think most of us would have the instinct that this is a bit like all these nasty questions which Born and von Karaman worried about many decades ago, you know, about whether the shape of the sample makes a huge difference to how you count the phonon modes and so forth. But I still think it's something which could use a little attention, possibly. I'm not seriously worried about it, but I'll just bring it up as something we might think about.
Some of these papers, they keep track of the initial momentum and the final momentum and both set them to zero, and one can do that, of course.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
As long as you just have two particles.
Well, right, but in these...
You're telling me we don't know how to solve a two-particle scattering problem.
In some sense, I think we know how to solve a two-particle scattering problem under certain idealized boundary conditions, I would say. It's not totally obvious to me that we know it more generally, and it just could be that in these circumstances it may make a difference. So, yes.
I really don't understand your the two-body scattering problem is usually solved in these relative coordinates, right? Go into angular momentum state,
yes.
Get phase shift.
That's right, yes. Yeah.
So that part, so this is an infinite space.
Yeah, that's right. We don't have infinite space in the area, I guess.
Now, but is your concern then how you fit this pair of particles into some enclosure?
Basically, yes. Yes. Yes.
Some definite size.
Yeah.
And shape.
Yes.
And
yeah.
So you mentioned the work of von Karman and Weyl on such boundary effects. There is a fair amount of knowledge of this. You know, they become, of course, unimportant relative to the logic if the
sure, yeah.
system is large
well,
enough. Do we have some measure here of what is the meaning of large enough?
Well, I mean, I suspect strongly that that the answer is that most experimental geometries are. That's a yeah. The
preference potential becomes
But that's obvious.
Yes, okay, maybe. Look, maybe I shouldn't have brought these up. I don't know.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
It simply means it's
what?
No problem.
What is the typical ratio of the size of the drop compared to
the scatter? Well, let's see. Typically, you've got a dimension of, 50, 100 microns, say, is that fair? And you've got a scattering length of maybe 100 to 1,000 angstroms. So it's a big ratio. Mm-hmm. Well, sure. Okay, maybe I should have brought it up. I don't know. Maybe I'm just being too finicky. Okay, so let me start off with the case where we can effectively regard our system as having spin zero, as being spinless. Now, okay, the conditions for that are actually quite stringent, but I think the odds are that in most of the existing experiments they have actually been satisfied. So let's just make that approximation for the moment. We'll forget about the internal hyperfine degree of freedom. And moreover, we are going to assume a repulsive interaction, so for practical purposes right now we're talking about rubidium-87 or sodium-23, which most of the experiments have been done. And then of course, typically, most of the traps have been magnetic in nature, and typically one has the following inequalities reasonably well satisfied. You have the ground state energy, H bar omega zero, in the ground state oscillation energy in the trap. This is much less than the typical mean field energy, number of particles times the effective interaction strength. This in turn is usually small compared to KTC, where TC is the transition temperature you're going to calculate for Bose condensation. This one is usually fairly well fulfilled. This one is a bit more problematic, I think, in the more recent cases. Not clear that that's your really extreme limit of that. Remember, incidentally, that KTC is of order for a magnetic trap is of order n to the 1/3 times h bar omega 0. So since n is typically of the order of a million or so, you have a factor of about 100 between here and here. So this one can sit nicely in the middle and usually does. So the first question is, do we expect Bose condensation? Now, there's a slight subtlety there, which I think a lot of people are not terribly conscious of, and I wasn't conscious of it until quite recently. It's this. Let's for the moment forget that we're dealing with alkali gases which have the odd electron and so forth, and just pretend we were dealing with helium-4 in this kind of geometry. And forget about it being a terribly strongly interacting system for the moment, because it's a sort of dilute gas, if you like, of helium-4, assuming you've had such a thing. Well, you have a helium-4 atom is made up of a nucleus, an alpha particle, and two electrons, right? So the boson component is the alpha particle, the nucleus. So we expect that if we take the if we look for example at the quantity psi r, let's call it psi alpha explicitly, psi alpha of r prime. Typical on the side of Penrose, one particle correlation function where alpha denotes the position of the nucleus, so forth. That is going to show long range order, and therefore we have Bose condensation, right? Wrong. Not so. A long history to this problem. Marvin Giraudot, who's going to be here later on the program, in the 60s wrote a whole series of papers which proved quite conclusively that this could not be true. Cannot get Bose condensation except in the trivial limit where the nuclei simply don't interact with the electrons. So if you try to define Bose condensation by just simply focusing on the position of the nuclei and averaging over everything the electrons are doing, you never get it. So why don't we worry about it? I think the answer is, my off-the-cuff answer at least, is, well, this is really not a terribly physical way of looking at things. What you actually want to do is to make the standard Born-Oppenheimer type of approximation, in which you, first of all, write down a wave function, phi, for the, let's call the nuclei now big R, okay, little r is the electrons. You write a wave function of this type, where the position of the wave function of the electrons now depends, crucially, on what the nuclei are doing. You then multiply it by a wave function which refers only to the nuclei, and under appropriate conditions you can show that this, approximately at least, satisfies a Schrodinger equation with some kind of effective internuclear potential. Okay? So what you should be doing, where Girardot's problem comes from, I believe, is this boost here. And what you should be doing is to concentrate on this boost. And as long as you do, there's absolutely nothing which says you can't have Bose condensation, and a lot of arguments which say you can. So, but I think it's an amusing point, because I say it's not I think, something which is often people are always conscious of. Okay, but fine, we'll go ahead with that. And I mean, we'll do what we always do, which is to basically write down a many-body Schrodinger equation, effective Schrodinger equation for the nuclear positions, with some kind of effective potential, which in turn depends on net beast and so forth, but which we think we know.
What is the physics of this definitive at this point?
It's because basically the electrons have to obey Fermi's statistics. And the most natural way of looking at this is that the electron wave function depends on the nuclear positions. But you could look at it the other way around, as it were. The nuclear wave function depends on the electron positions. And I could not reproduce off the top of my head Girardot's argument. It's quite subtle. It takes 10 pages in the Journal of Mathematical Physics. But basically I think that's what's behind it. That in some sense, the Fermi statistics obeyed by the electrons are infecting the nuclei in this way. As I say, he points out that in the trivial case where there's no interaction and therefore no correlation in here, then of course you have no problem.
Well,
in
some sense, it's just more open than an approximation, of course, is an approximation.
Yep.
And does that mean that one might, in the real system, you would not have a true condensation?
My interpretation of this, which I have to say I can't prove rigorously, but I think it's extremely plausible, is that if you define Bose condensation, as it were, formally, by simply looking at the positions of the nuclei and averaging over the electron wave function, then you will never get Bose condensation. If you do it what I think is a more physical way, that is, take out this bit of the wave function, which in some sense merely defines the structure of an atom in some way, and just look at the effective wave function of the nuclei, then there seems to be no problem, as far as I can see.
Is there a problem if you look at the wave function of the entire atom?
Then there is a problem, yes. Yeah. Why? Well, as I say, I can't reproduce. I'm afraid I can't reproduce this off the top of my head. It's a quite complicated argument which uses a lot of. Sorry. Well, two fermions don't make. I mean, the point, in some sense, the point of Girardot's work was to show that you can't always regard two fermions as simply equivalent to a boson. There are. Well, it depends what you want to do with it. So, very likely, you could play the same game with the at that level if you really wanted to. I mean, no one is bothered, but I guess you could at the level of the nucleus, regarded as a composite of fermions. Yeah, probably. No, well, we have a problem. Again, as long as you do what I think most of us regard as the physically sensible thing, which is to take out this bit of the wave function, which is basically just telling you about the internal structure of the atom.
I cranked up the fine structure constant. I had a very strongly worn up and argument to really break down. I wouldn't have.
Yeah. Then you might not. Then I suspect if you crank it up enough, you might not get condensation at all. Yeah.
Why not?
doesn't want to create the atom. I mean, just
what? Well, that's what I'm doing here. Yes,
the
dagger exactly. That's what. Exactly. That's what I'm saying. That's exactly what I'm saying. By focusing on this bit, you do just that. So, okay. Well, again, just thought I'd draw it to your attention.
Do you absolutely believe this?
Girardot's paper.
Well, if you look at the wrong correlation function, it doesn't exhibit off diagonal range order.
Well, fine, but you had to. But not everyone, the moment I wrote this up, said that's the wrong correlation function, right?
No, but what is
finite
condition of the.
Well, as a matter of fact, I think it's probably. Sorry?
What is the thing that doesn't.
If this is the. This simply creates a nucleus. And a nucleus here, and then you average over the electron coordinates. Okay, no surprise maybe, but still, a bit of history I think this was worth mentioning. Okay,
coming back to one plus, I mean, two electrons do make a boson. We have superconductivity.
It's a language I find very convenient, and I think many of us find very convenient. But we can't do everything. I mean, you know, we really can't do everything with two fermions that we can do with a boson.
But they can evolve the
convention. But is the issue of the scale of electronic excitation energies and that somehow the stratosphere can get involved?
Yeah. Because
if you
can
find it,
well, say, surely, I think the boson. I mean, I think we have to look. I think we need to define our question precisely, and all I mean, in some sense, once we've sort of been through this argument, I think the point is completely trivial, but it simply says that it's not sensible to define our long-range order in terms of simply the nuclear positions averaged over the electron wave functions. But, sorry,
it's a very uncritical thing to do, and if it gets strange results, I don't care.
Well, fine. fine, but this, I can tell you, I mean, it's not the kind of case where I can name names, but I can tell you that there have been some really quite experienced people who've been confused by this point, I think, you know, it's one that's just worth mentioning. Okay, but let's go on to something more real, as it were. So we've got now got our system in a magnetic trap, and we're going to handle it in a sensible way, defining our Bose condensation in a sensible way, and we all believe that weak interactions, at least, we are indeed going to get Bose condensation at low enough temperatures, and crudely speaking, the transition temperature is going to be of this order in a harmonic potential well. Okay, so what do we know about the shape of the condensate? Well, we've all been through this argument before. You have a harmonic well. You have a the normal state, a nice smoothed out roughly Maxwell distribution. It's not quite Maxwell, but pretty much Maxwell. If I had a non-interacting gas, then in the ground state, the ground state wave function is something like this, and so you get at zero temperature, get all your particles condensed into this state, and get this enormous spike. Now, clearly, that's not what we see experimentally in the alkali gases. Why not? Well, clearly, because of their repulsive interaction, which tends to broaden the distribution. And so, what we expect to get is something more like perhaps this, and because as we cool down through the transition temperature, what we expect is that this peak begins to stand up above the background. And sure enough, that does seem to be what's seen, at least qualitatively, in the MIT experiments where they actually do the imaging in situ. Of course, as most of you know, the history of the subject is a bit complicated by the fact that the very first experiments, 2.5 years ago, did not have the facility to do in-situ imaging of the density distribution. What they had to do was to expand the trap and then look at the velocity distributions. Which is, okay, I mean, it's a fairly simple relation between those, but it's slightly more complicated, and I think it's much nicer, in a way, to be able to just look at this peak appearing directly, which is precisely what the MIT people do. So far, no great problems. Incidentally, how do we define Bose condensation in this kind of geometry, and for a finitely interacting system? I think, yeah.
What is the actual size of the Chomsky wave function?
I don't have that figure in my head. What I can tell you is that it's very considerably less than the typical thermal excursion at TC, and one can work out what power of it in that goes according to, I think it's end of the 1/6, isn't it? Sorry? 100 to 200 microns for the ground state wave function. So, would that be? Sorry, you're talking about the broadened one, aren't you? Not the zero, the non-interacting one. Yeah. Okay. The Broughton one, yes, is of that order. Harmonic oscillator. Yes. Good. And okay. So typically in most of the experiments to date, the broadening has been by a factor of the order of 5 to 10. I think, hasn't it? So, typical number. Okay. How do we define Bose condensation for an interacting system? Well, we have various possibilities, but I think, to my mind, in this kind of geometry, where I can't take the limit of infinite volume and so forth, by far the simplest definition is one which is essentially Penrose-Ontz argument, though slight modifications. Namely, what I do is I look at my appropriately defined one-particle density matrix, alpha beta, R prime, and and my definition of Bose condensation is basically that it has one eigenvalue, and only one, which is comparable to the total number of particles, and all the others are zero. And then having done that, I can always find, once I've got that that result, I can always find an appropriate representation in which this is diagonal. And then, by definition, in the representation where it's diagonal, I can write it in the form, I can write this beast in the form sum of n, ni times phi I, phi I of r, phi I star of r prime. Now I take the particular term, which is macroscopically occupied here, where ni is of order n, and then by definition it's the associated phi, which is the condensate wave function. Okay. And then if I want to define my order parameter, the most obvious way to do it, so as to get agreement with what's been done in other ways, is simply to say that my order parameter, let's call it capital Psi, of R and T, and so this is also works if this is time dependent, so we've got a T in here, you can get a T in here, Psi of R and T is the square root of N0 of T, the square root of the condensate number, multiplied by Phi 0 of R and T. Now that seems to me a perfectly sensible and good definition. It doesn't, as I emphasised earlier, it does not require the idea of broken U1 symmetry, and I think, in fact, that there are some dangers in introducing the idea of U1 symmetry in this case. Which... Sorry? Yeah, there are Goldstone bosons, yes. Sorry? Well, actually, for a Goldstone boson, you do want a translation invariant system, I think. Whether you should regard the quadrupolar collective excitations in this kind of trap as a Goldstone boson or not, I think it's probably a matter of terminology. What one can say... crudely speaking, well, not exactly as one of the size, one of the square root of the size, I think, in this case. But crudely speaking, rather obviously, there are going to be phonon-like modes. For example, there's this simple dipole mode in which you just slosh backwards and forwards. I'm not quite. But you see, in ordinary helium, I mean, also the phonons have to do with translation symmetry, in some sense. I don't think that the phonon spectrum in helium 4.
This U1 symmetry, there aren't any.
Well, I mean, I think that may be just a matter of terminology. Let's think for a moment about helium-4. people would like to think that in helium-4, the phonons are Goldstone bosons, fine, associated with a broken neuon symmetry. Well, fine, but one of the things you have to remember experimentally is that when you go through TC, nothing happens, basically, to those phonons. They're still there, like, on the high side of it.
No, but there's a second sound.
Well, you want to say the second sound is there?
No.
Well, okay, I mean, yeah, sure, but that,
but,
yeah, sure, so there will be a second sound type mode at any finite temperature in the system. So, I mean, if those are what you'd like to call the Goldstone bosons, okay.
No, but remember, that has, it isn't the local symmetry that gets built.
Okay. Well, so ground state, we generally believe that broken neuon symmetry or not, the ground state does have this this structure, very roughly speaking, and we moreover believe that this can be rather well characterized by the as a solution of the Gross-Podiavsky equation. And of course, as you all know, the Gross-Podiavsky equation is nothing but a fancy name for the Hartree equation in this case, in a boson or system at zero temperature. So basically, we've just got a self-consistent Hartree wave function. The atoms move in a potential, which is the sum of the external potential and a self-consistent internal potential. And I think by now we're fairly familiar with the solution to that. Okay, where do we? What's the next approximation to that? Well, presumably, just based on our experience with helium-4, which is a translation invariant system, the next thing to do would be to introduce the generalization of the Bogoliubov approximation. And as far as I can see, that seems to be well understood. Basically, it's just the boson analog of the Bogoliubov-Dejean equations in a Fermi system. And we can write down the equations, the Bogoliubov equations for this system, and in principle solve one. It may be a pain, but we can do it. So I think that's a case where, at this stage at least, we think we have got everything under control, and the problems are mostly computational. Because if you want to go beyond the Bogoliubov approximation, that becomes a much stickier business. If we really knew how to go beyond the Bogoliubov approximation consistently, then presumably we have a much better theory of helium-4 than we actually do. Luckily, it seems unlikely that we're going to have to go beyond the Bogoliubov approximation for this kind of system. Yeah.
For superconductors.
Yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yes. Yeah.
By the density.
Yep.
In the case of supercooled, by two densities.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
The supercooled density and the polar density.
Yep.
And in that way, you can, if the external potential is sufficiently slowly varying, then you can introduce the properties of the homogeneous system at including the main-body correlation effect.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Provided you have information about the density of the homogeneous system, it's too much about the energy or free energy of the finite temperatures of the homogeneous system for various densities.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to me the geometry here, I have to ask myself, but when should I count exponential slowly bearing? On what scale?
Okay.
Since you are saying this is, this is really a very large of any atomic scale.
I agree. In fact, it's interesting you bring that up because I hadn't actually discussed the question of finite temperature yet. But at finite temperatures, then indeed there is a calculation one can do, which is very much along the kind of lines you mentioned. And In fact, such a calculation was first done in the context of spin polarized hydrogen way back in 1981 in a paper which I think, rather unfortunately is never cited in the literature these days. And this is the paper by Condart and Guyer in Physro sometime in 1981. It's actually back-to-back with a paper by Vic Goldman, Ike Silvera and myself, which does get cited, so I think it's very unfair that they don't, because they basically do rather similar things. But what they do precisely in that paper is to develop a sort of local density approximation for the normal and superfluid components, along the kind of lines you mentioned. But in any case, I think even in the case of spin polarized hydrogen, and far more in the case of the alkalis, the quantitative corrections to a free gas picture seem to be in some sense very small. Now, okay, one has to be careful about that statement. I mean, it's clearly not a small effect when you've actually blown up the condensate by a factor of 5 or 10. But the thing, it looks as if the Hartree approximation in itself should still be rather good under those circumstances. And one doesn't even have to go, for most purposes, one doesn't even have to go as far as Bogoliubov. One can just get away with Hartree. There is a special question discuss the finite temperature static properties. And also, I think one can at least make this kind of two fluid local density approximation. There are, of course, very specific questions which arise concerned with the transition temperature. And one amusing question which has been around for a long time in the context of helium and has now got some sense of revived interest is what is the sign of the effect of interactions on the transition temperature? Do repulsive interactions put the transition temperature down or up? And there's a nice paper recently by Frank Leloy and his collaborators, which discusses that point computationally. And it'd be interesting, I think, to see how far one could recover the results of that calculation analytically, whether there is a simple analytic way of covering it. Right. Frank's answer is that the answer of Frank and his collaborators is that for weak interactions, the transition temperature for repulsive interactions, the transition temperature goes up, and then it goes down if you get too strong. The rise is because of the Nij term, or crudely speaking. The drop is presumably because of a sort of mutual inhibition effect. The atoms have a job sliding past one another. And that's nice. I mean, that result is nice in the sense that, of course, for helium-4, the transition temperature is lower than what you calculate for the non-interacting case. Hopefully. And so it'd be nice to... That's a numerical computation. It'd be nice to see if one could do that a little bit. Okay, now let's get to something a bit more interesting, perhaps. The thermal properties of finite temperatures, because that is something on which some experiments have been done. As far as I can see, no good reason to think we don't understand those, at least approximately, on the basis of a relatively weakly interacting gas, a picture. We can calculate, for example, the fraction of normal component. We can calculate the specific heat and so forth. And the experiments, of course, have a lot of error bars on them, but they look as if that's working out, roughly. Now, the first really controversial question, I think, which, other than these little sort of bits of history that I raised, is the question of the dynamics of the condensate. And in particular, lots and lots of calculations have been done by simply generalizing the static Gross-Katayevsky equation to be time dependent. So in other words, you write down I h bar d scalar of psi by dt equals minus h plus 7 of 2m del squared psi, plus an external potential term of t psi, plus u0 psi squared psi. That's the time-dependent Gross-Vedovsky equation. And I think, as I say, this equation has been used in a vast variety of different contexts. And I think it's very important to discuss, take at least a moment to discuss, what are likely to be the limits of validity of that equation. I think it may be helpful in this context to separate out the order parameter explicitly into a term which reflects the occupation number and a term which reflects the actual normalized wave function into which the condensate forms. And then I believe one has the following situation. If you actually take out the factor of in zero and write instead of this an equation for the condensate wave function, let's call it chi zero. Let me just change my notation a little. I'll call it chi zero. H bar d chi zero by dt equals minus h bar squared over 2m del squared plus vx. Plus, then you have to rewrite this term as in u0 chi 0 rt 0 of t. Sorry, in 0 of t here, chi 0 of rt. What's the validity of that equation? I believe, and I incidentally, some of these points which I'm spending a little more time, I have got written up in some notes I brought along with me. So if people are interested in having a bit more details of some of these arguments, they could look at those. I believe the validity of this equation is basically much the same as the validity of the static equation. That is, it's valid to the extent that I'm prepared to neglect the effects of correlations which go beyond the Hartree approximation. Maybe this is a tautology in a sense, I guess. However, it's not quite a tautology for the following reason. Assume that this condition is fulfilled. This condition is only going to lead to this one if, in addition, n0 is not a function of t, of time. Now, that really brings us to the crunch, then. When is it not a good approximation to assume that the number of particles in the condensate is independent of time? It's fairly clear, of course, that In an interacting system where there are collisions, those collisions are liable to change the condensate number. I mean, if that were not the case, we'd never get Bose condensation in the first place. So that's certainly true. What's somewhat less obvious, and I think a rather tricky question, is what happens if we're prepared to work on a short enough timescales that the collisions are pretty negligible? Which is not, typically in these systems, the rate of collision in the usual sense of kinetic theory can be quite long. I mean, it can be seconds. So we can certainly do operations over a timescale much shorter than that case. However, of course, that does not assure us that the number of particles in the condensate is going to be fixed. If I manipulate my potential sufficiently violently, then all the odds are it's not going to be fixed. And that is a point, I think, which really is rather crucial to explore in the context of, for example, some of the expansion experiments. Everyone does just that. Now, one has a rather general way of handling, in principle, of handling this kind of problem, and it's the so-called adiabatic approximation. In general, if I have a system which starts, a many-body system which starts off in some energy eigenstate M, and I then let the Hamiltonian be time-dependent, and I ask, what is the amplitude for a different state N at time t? And then, give or take a few factors, the answer is basically the following expression. I integral from 0 to t, so this is a bit of a miss, this one, but we might as well write it out. dh by dt prime in m, 1 over en of t prime minus en of t prime, exponential minus I integral t prime 0 dt double prime, En of t double prime minus em, divided by h bar. That's a miss. But that is basically the expression for the, if you like, the transition amplitude, the amplitude that I start with the state m at time zero and end up with the state n at time t. And here it's important to be clear that this term is the explicit, reflects the explicit dependence of the Hamiltonian on time. And trivially, if H is independent of time, then the whole thing just goes away, as course it should. Okay? That's the standard lowest order non-trivial adiabatic approximation. Now, there's a sort of rather generic argument which says that, okay, let's stare at this expression. If the actual rate of change, if the rate of change of the Hamiltonian is fairly slow, that is, if dh by dt itself is a fairly slowly varying function of time, then this oscillation is likely to kill you off very badly here. And so, crudely speaking, if the characteristic time, tor, associated with the change of the Hamiltonian in time, and if the state I'm trying to excite differs from the ground state by some frequency omega, then in the limit omega tor much less than 1, what we'll find is that this amplitude is very small. This is, of course, for those who are more familiar with a different application of this, this is, of course, basically nothing other than the well-known considerations which you use in the history of the early universe about creation of mesons and so forth by a slowly varying space-time metric. Basically, if omega tor is much less than 1, this amplitude falls off at least as some power of omega tor, and very often exponentially, as exponential minus 1 over omega tor squared or something of the kind. So it depends on the exact analytic properties, what it does. Now, what does that mean? That means that, very crudely speaking, that we will get away with the time-dependent Gross-Podolsky theory, or we may be able to get away with it, provided that the timescale over which our potential is varying is long compared to the inverse frequency of the lowest modes that we would like to be able to excite. Fine. That may be true. It may be true in sense under certain experimental conditions. Certainly not true under all experimental conditions. And in particular, it's unlikely to be true in many of the trap expansion experiments. Now, at this point, we have to notice that in the literature of the last couple of years, there are a couple of very elegant papers which consider just this situation, the expansion of a harmonic trap. One is by Kagan and, I think, Svistinov, but certainly Kagan and co-workers, and the other is by Castan and Dunn. And what these papers show is that if you take a harmonic trap and you simply change the force constant, and remember, taking the barrier away altogether is just putting the force constant to zero, so it's a special case. So you change the force constant. No matter what the time scale over which you change it, the TdGP equation is still exactly, well, is still, to a very good approximation, satisfied. The statement is that it's satisfied exactly in the so-called Thomas Fermi limit, in which which is the one usually believed to apply to most of the alkalis most of the time, where I should have mentioned that point. The Thomas Fermi limit, basically, is the limit in which the interaction energy is large compared to characteristic bending energy of the wave function. And as I say, the alkalis usually are in that limit. So how do we? So we've now got this funny result, or well, apparently funny result. Kagan and company and Castan and Dunn have showed us that I can do basically whatever I like with a harmonic trap, and I will never violate the Gross-Podolsky equation. Whereas this, at first sight at least, this calculation seems to be saying, well, I would expect to violate it. So what's gone wrong? I think at this point, I think the answer is the following, but there's still something I'm trying to think more about. The case of varying a harmonic trap is very special. By definition in that problem, dh by dt is simply some function of time times r squared. Okay, because remember, I've always got a harmonic trap with a finite or zero spring constant, and I'm merely varying that spring constant as a function of time. So in other words, dh by dt, the operator dh by dt, is simply k r squared, actually, sum of I, strictly speaking, or I squared.
Yes. Gravity.
Okay. Gravity is an important effect in these systems. For a single spin species, basically all it does is to shift the zero, as it were, since it's a linear term. If you've got more than one spin species, you really have to worry, because gravity will tend, well, the combined effects of gravity and the differential magnetic field will tend to pull the different spin species apart. Yeah. But I think for this purpose, you can, let's see, gravity will simply supply an extra linear term which you can get rid of by an appropriate choice of zero, hopefully. I mean, basically, you start with, forget about gravity and define your magnetic trap, okay? You then put on the linear term, and all it does basically is shift to zero, so it hopefully goes away. Okay, so now what's special about this? Well, what this beast is, of course, is nothing other than the so-called quadrupole operator, and one can actually do a lot of nice analysis of the states which can and can't contribute here. Let me just remind you that in the more or less trivial case, where you're talking about excitation by a dipole operator, that is, suppose that the operator in here were just sum of I, Ri, okay? That is trivial, because, I mean, you know what's going to happen. That operator only excites slotted motion backwards and forwards. And there's a single mode, namely the first excited state of the harmonic oscillator, which it excites. End of story. This one is not quite so trivial, but you can still do some rather nice analysis on it using some arguments. And what you can actually show is quite explicitly, it's not something you have to build in by hand, you can show quite explicitly that in the Thomas Fermi limit, then this operator simply excites the collective modes of the collective quantiform modes of the trap. And these are the ones, one of them has a square root of 5 omega 0, and the other has square root of 2, I guess. But in any case, both those modes are, honest to goodness, collective slotting movement motions of the condensate. There's nothing else. What the sum rules tell you is that those exhaust the sum rule completely. There's nothing. So you can't excite anything more complicated than just these collective motions of the condensate. So I claim that that is why the Kagan-Kastan-Dum result it works, as it were. It's something very special to a simple variation of spring constant in a harmonic trap.
Can you point out where in this treatment they use the fact that they have a harmonic trap, and for example, that they cannot move like that the trap instead of opening it?
If they superimposed a dipole excitation on the quadrupole one, it wouldn't make any difference, because the dipole excitation, again, by the simple sum rule arguments, can only excite collective excitations. But anything more complicated than that,
okay,
I think.
Doing something like that.
Then I think it will work.
Where in the treatment this approximation is done?
Well,
I remember the paper, but I don't know what it is.
No, I think you'll... I didn't have as much time to spend on this as I would have wished ideally. I mean, I only thought of these considerations very recently. But I believe that you'll find that the scaling arguments, the scaling transformations they make, will only work for that specific form of potential. It will not work for an arbitrary potential.
So in this paper, they don't talk about... scaling transformation. I mean, the one in which they relate the Gross-Pitayesky equation to the original Hamiltonian. I mean, this is a different paper. And the other in which they find the justification for the Gross-Pitayesky equation, which I think is not published yet.
Oh, okay. So then that's why I don't know about it. Okay. Yes. So fine. I would like to see that, and we can then again perhaps go through it and discuss it. But I do think that this is something which would be very nice to sort out one way or the other, definitively. Okay. Where were we? Yes. Okay. So as I say, the validity of TGDP is an important question, which I hope we'll discuss further. Another major group of questions, of course, is associated with the actual kinetics of the Bose condensation process. There have been various theories in the literature in the context of helium 4 and similar extended systems. And let me just mention, because I don't think it's universally known, that there is a famous paradox which was first formulated by Levitch and Yochot way back about 25 years ago now, I think, which says that basically you'll never get, that in the thermodynamic limit you never get Bose condensation. And the argument is a very simple one, based on kinetic theory, and simply says that Levitch and Yochot It's in Soviet Physics JTP way back in the 60s or 70s, I guess. And what they basically observed the following. They just took a simple kinetic theory kind of approach, and they noted that in the expression for the rate of change of N0, dN0 by dt, you had various other factors which are not particularly important to us, but you also have and let's just lump those all into some kind of effective relaxation time, but you also had a N0 plus 1, which is the... the famous Bose factor for going into the final state of zero. And now they made the simple observation that if you actually solve that equation, you find that in the thermodynamic limit, the time of Bose condensation goes as tau times log n. So in the thermodynamic limit, you get no post-condensation. Some features. I'm not sure that everyone is conscious that all the people who've done calculations on condensation in finite worlds are conscious explicitly of that result. But it does seem amusing that if you look at some of the results of some of these calculations using the kinetic theory for a finite trap, where they vary the number, it does seem to have approximately that logarithmic dependence. So, the real question is, does one take this seriously or not? And I suspect strongly that the answer is no, one shouldn't take it seriously, because it, in some sense, it relies on too literal a definition of Bose condensation, or if you like to put it a slightly different way, it relies on applying a kinetic theory argument under conditions where there's no real reason to believe that kinetic theory is the right description. And a very, as many of you will know, there's a very interesting series of papers which actually were started long before the BC alkali gases by Kagan and his co-workers, where they've studied the different stages in the kinetics of condensation in detail, and they've studied, for example, how the initial thermal distribution relaxes to one which is very strongly peaked at low energies, and then how you gradually freeze out things like phonons and vortices and so on and so forth. And so, Yuri Kagan, of course, is coming later to this program, so I hope we'll hear more about that from him. But I think certainly, it seems to me that there are quite a lot of quite interesting unsolved problems in that area. Now we come to what, of course, is in some sense the most spectacular experiments, I guess, which have been done on the alkali gases so far, which are the interference experiments, where you basically start with two wells, condensate formed in two different wells, like so. I've got condensate here. You then take down suddenly the barrier and allow them to expand towards one another in other directions. And then you ask, do I expect to see an interference pattern? Do I see an interference pattern? And so I think this experiment actually raises a number of very intriguing conceptual issues. The first question, of course, is what's the correct initial description of these two states? Now, it's very tempting to say to simply do, as indeed the experimentalists in their paper do, they simply say, well, we know how high this barrier is, it's a laser-form barrier. We can actually work out some kind of WKB exponent for tunneling through here, and from that we get some kind of tunneling time. And that turns out to be several orders of magnitude times the age of the universe, or whatever. And since we actually cooled this stuff down in the order of a minute, then we can reasonably say that these two Bose condensates form completely independently. Actually, it's not quite that simple. I mean, I suspect the answer is right, but it's not in fact quite that simple, because if you actually ask yourself, okay, given that the quantum tunneling, the WKB probability, was that small, what about thermal activation over the barrier? Okay, is that negligible? Answer, no, not at all. There's plenty of time for quite a lot of particles to migrate by thermal activation over the barrier. Now, I think your instinct and mine would probably be, okay, that doesn't really affect the issue. We still expect that the Bose condensate forms independently. In other words, there's no definite phase realised between the states of this kind. Now, I suspect that's right, but I think perhaps a little more thought about that would be useful. Then, of course, the next question is, okay, suppose that's right. Suppose that we formed two independent Bose condensates here. Well, they start in a Fock state. That is, Fock state, of course, is just a fancy name for a state in which the number of particles on each side is fixed. So do we expect to see interference or not? And there, of course, is a well-known trap which one is liable to fall into if one isn't careful, which is to simply calculate the quantity rho of R when the after a certain time when the quantum state's expanded. And if they start in Fock states, sure enough, you find no particular structure in this. So it's tempting at this point to say, okay, well, no interference. Wrong, because as a number of groups did in fact point out before the experiment was done. And the answer is not right. What this is telling you, the fact that this is basically some boring constant, is merely telling you the following, not very interesting piece of information. That if I focus on a particular point in the intermediate region, and I just do this experiment repeatedly and always take shots of that point, and then superimpose the photographs, I'm going to see nothing interesting. In other words, the average, and won't depend on which point I do that at. Okay? Now that of course is not what you do in the actual experiment. What you do in the actual experiment is to do a single expansion and take the photograph of the whole thing at one time. Now do you expect to see interference pattern or not? Answer yes, you do. And I think the easiest way, the easiest way to see this is as a sort of glorified n-particle version of the Hanbury-Brown twist effect. Remember that in the Hanbury-Brown twist, what you have is that you have two sources here, both emitting photons, very crude, and they can, the photons can arrive, say, here and here. And now, if I may have two mutually incoherent sources here. So if I just look at the probability of getting a photon arriving here, then basically it can either come from here or from here, and these are different processes, and therefore there's no interference between them. So the intensity here is just the sum of the intensities from the single particle sources. Now let me look at the probability of simultaneously getting a photon arriving here and here. Then, of course, I found there are two possibilities, that either this guy could have gone here, this one here, or alternatively, could have gone here, this one here. And there's no way of distinguishing those two possibilities, so I've got to add the amplitudes, and lo and behold, I get an interference term in my my two-photon correlation probability. And in some sense, I guess, I think it's possible and perhaps helpful to look at the MIT interference experiment as a sort of n-particle version of that situation. What that makes clear, incidentally, is that although Bose condensation is certainly a sufficient condition for seeing interference, it's not obviously a necessary condition. You can fix up, perhaps not very plausible, and certainly not very experimentally relevant under the present circumstances, you can set up initial configurations such that there's no Bose condensation, but you'll still get a finite interference pattern. Now, all of this, of course, is all very nice, and in some sense, maybe I'm wrong about this because I don't know too much about the history, but my impression is that one very useful guide which people had in thinking about this experiment initially came from quantum optics, because indeed you get rather similar phenomena occurring with lasers. If you switch on two independent lasers, then they very soon develop an interference pattern, mutual interference pattern, and so forth. So it seems then interesting at this point to ask the question, well, is everything really quite the same as it is in quantum optics? Or are there some subtle differences? And I think, yeah.
What's the interference pattern actually
seen?
What's the nature of it?
Well, you got a series of dark and bright stripes as a function of how do they actually measure the? It's quite complicated, but crudely speaking, it's an optical absorption experiment. They wait for the thing to have sort of expanded enough to possibly interfere. Then they do a series of operations. But at the end of the day, basically, is that they shine a light beam through and look to see how far it's what proportion is transmitted. I think that I haven't misrepresented anything there, have I? I think that's basically what goes on in that experiment. Yeah. As I say, there's a whole lot of preliminary operations. They've got to change the hard-to-find state so as to make it more susceptible to the absorption and so forth. But that's the guts of it. So basically, what this is a measurement of is effectively the one particle density as a function of space, and in principle of time, though they actually do it over a rather short time period. As I say, I think in some sense some of the most interesting questions are associated with things which just might be different in this case from what they are in quantum optics. One thing which is obviously different is the actual nature of, as Walter just pointed out, is the nature of the detection process. In quantum optics, because the standard detection process is to absorb your photon in a photodetector or whatever, and then you've lost your photon and it's gone. Now, in this case, that's not what you're doing. You're measuring the density, and that's a in some sense a conserved quantity. So your atoms are still there after you've passed your radiation through. And that may or may not make a difference. I mean, there has been some recent discussion in recent preprints, I know, of this point. It looks like it probably doesn't make a very severe difference as far as anyone can see. The second point, I think it's probably right now of rather academic interest, but still strikes me as conceptually very interesting, and that's the following. Photons don't, effectively, don't interact with one another. They don't have any kind of except at a very, very tiny level, they don't have any kind of Hartree-Fock interaction. Atoms do. What difference is this going to make? Now, as far as I know, and I hope people will correct me if I'm wrong, if I've missed something, but as far as I know, in the literature, this has usually been handled, this question has usually been handled simply by assuming that you can write down a time-dependent Ginzburg-Kitayevsky equation and solve it. But I have a feeling that it is more subtle than that. The point is roughly this. Let me try and put it in words briefly. I've got these two beams expanding. The mere existence of interference is in some sense a sign that I can't tell which of the two beams the atom I'm seeing has come from. If there was a tag, if for example we had different spin, hyperfine orientations at the start of the experiment, which is in principle possible but hasn't been done, then you wouldn't expect to see any interference. Okay? In some sense, what you can say is that this kind of measurement is phase fixing, that is, it's measuring the relative phase of the atoms in the two beams. We'll see that because if you start, in principle at least, you can start with a definite relative phase of these condensates, which you just sort of tweak by a knob, and look to see what happens to the interference pattern, and sure enough, it shifts as you change the relative phase. So this is what I call a phase fixing measurement. Now, the question is, are there, as it were, number-fixing interactions in the problem too? The answer is yes. The reason is that famous factor of two that I mentioned on Monday. Namely, if I really start with a single coherent state, then the atoms within that state interact with one another by u n squared. If the atoms if I start with two orthogonal states, then they have this extra factor of two u n I. So there is in principle, there is an energy in the problem which would like to fix the relative number in the two beams rather than the relative phase, because in some sense, there are many ways of showing these are conjugate variables. So, now, I strongly suspect that in the existing experiments, the reason that they've worked so beautifully and given such beautiful agreement with the predictions based on, as it were, neglecting this effect is quite simply the density is so small. But in future applications, and in particular if one ever gets to the stage of really making a useful atom laser and so forth, then one may no longer be in that limit. So one really has to worry now about the competition between phase fixing and number fixing effects. And again, of course, this is going to depend quite substantially on the actual power of the detection method which you're using. I mean, the actual wattage of the detection measuring. Okay. Attractive. Yeah. Where are we going? Well. Okay. Well, can I just take a few minutes more? And I guarantee to get out by two. But, you know. it's 22 now, right? Is that right? Yeah. The attractive case. Well, a lot of that is lithium, lithium 7, basically. A lot of interesting problems there, I think. We know. Here's a problem which I've discussed with a few of you already, which I think is quite amusing. Imagine a set of lithium-7 atoms, that is an attractive S-wave interaction, in a box, a finite box. We know that one particle does nothing interesting, but also two particles do nothing interesting. Okay, all they do is to scatter with a negative scattering thing. Okay. On the other hand, if we use mean field theory, we know that in the thermodynamic limit, the whole thing certainly just collapses and globs up in one corner of the box. So there has to be some finite number between 2 and infinity at which this process starts. In other words, it's a sort of droplet problem. What is the minimum number of lithium-7 atoms needed to make a droplet?
Two, yeah. They don't bind.
No, well, okay. There's clearly a very important point here, which perhaps I should just mention. The if I have two spin parallel lithium 7 atoms, the potential looks actually something like that, and here are a whole set of vibrational levels sitting down there. So they do bind in principle. In practice, everyone just sort of totally forgets about that for the reason that for two-body processes in free space, there are so many selection rules that have to be violated to form this state that basically it never happens, or at least not over the period of a lifetime of graduate students. So basically you just forget about all these levels and just characterise everything by this way scattering this. Somewhere between 2 and infinity, there's got to be a sort of critical droplet. That, I think, is an amusing problem, although it's a problem in some sense of chemical physics, more than anything else. And it clearly has analogues in the formation of helium droplets and so on and so forth. Next question, given that too many, we all know that if I put too many lithium 7 atoms in a given harmonic well, that it's unstable against presumably some kind of collapse. But what actually happens? What is the actual kinetics of that process? In the Rice, the most recent Rice experiments, they interpret their results by saying, well, the sort of periodic collapse and reformation of the condensate. Is that what really happens? And, you know, well, where do the atoms actually go? Do they just recombine and get lost, or what? No one really knows, I think. And among, well, a whole lot of other interesting questions associated with that. Okay, that's past experiments, as best I can summarise them. Future experiments, I'm going to have to be very quick, otherwise we're not going to get finished by 2 o'clock. There's been a lot of discussion. I'd be interested in getting comments on this, informally afterwards. There's been a lot of discussion in the literature on possible optical effects of the Bose condensation process. And yet, it seems to me that there's actually a rather strong constraint on the speculations, because at least if we just consider a single bulk system, one of the very interesting things is that in helium-4, which everyone believes is an honest to goodness Bose system, the optical properties basically don't tell you about that at all. There's almost no signature in the optical properties of the lambda temperature, except the usual critical fluctuations, which would occur at any second order phase transition. But apart from that, no signature, as far as one can see, of Bose condensation in the optical properties. Now, maybe that's just because helium is a very dense and strongly interacting system, or maybe there's a more fundamental reason for it. The thesis I would like to make, and I've discussed this with one or two people already, is the following. At least so long as I'm not in some kind of super-radiant regime, that is, provided that n lambda cubed is much less than 1, where a lambda is the typical optical wavelength involved, then I would claim that basically any optical measurement one can do on a Bose condensed system, or for that matter on any many-body system, is effectively equivalent to simply measuring the correlations of perhaps not just two-particle correlations, maybe many, many in correlations of the particle density, rho of R and T. And in particular, if I'm just doing a sort of weak scattering experiment so that I can go to second order in perturbation theory, all I ever measure is that beast, basically, the two-particle density correlation function. And so if indeed there are spectacular effects which we're going to see in the optics, it has to be because that beast changes its shape, which of course it does, but I mean then we can see it in other ways too. So there's nothing very, what I claim then, is that there's nothing very very special about the optics as distinct from other kinds of probe. Josephson effect. Something we'll certainly like to see, something which some of us at least have been, I know various people here have been thinking about. I think I'd better skip that because A, it's going to take me 10 or 15 minutes, and B, Fernando, I guess, is going to be talking about it anyway on Friday. Rotational effects, the sort of problem that Ignacio raised yesterday, of course, is a very interesting one. Can one set the fluid into rotation by some kind of optical pulsing? Another possibility, of course, would be to set it into rotation, as it were, thermodynamically, that is, by actually rotating the potential as a function of time. But then, again, we get into all these nasty questions about how is equilibrium obtained with the rotating, or is it ever attained, in fact?
Short question.
Yes.
Here. Do you have a spherically symmetric potential?
Yeah, no. So you have to sum the symmetry. Yeah.
Into this sandwich and then yeah.
With helium, people take buckets, which are approximately cylindrical, but have little rugosities on the edge, and that appears to set the fluid into rotation rather well. So I don't see in principle why we shouldn't do the same thing. That might take a long time. You might have lost your sample by the end of it. Then, of course, there's a whole complex of questions surrounding the atom laser, and Martin, I guess, is going to be talking about that, so I probably shouldn't try to say much about that. So far, everything I've said has neglected the hyperfine degree of freedom. But in fact, the hyperfine degree of freedom is one of the most interesting ways in which these systems differ from previous Bose-condensed systems, so one ought to think about what one can do with it. There should be, certainly, and this is something which has been discussed in the literature, there should be some interesting optical, if you like, internal Josephson effect type of phenomena, which will be somewhat similar, presumably, to what happens in helium-3A. We do have an example of one system where we've seen a sort of internal Josephson effect of this type, and that is helium-3A. And one hopefully might be able to use some of the experience accumulated with that to discuss this. However, one has an enormous advantage in this system. The analogue of the dipole term in helium-3A, which basically drives cuber pairs between two bands, is the Raman laser in the alkali case. You can't switch your dipole energy on and off, but you can switch your laser on and off. So this means that you can do a whole series of experiments which, as it were, of a transient nature, which you couldn't do with superfluid helium-3. Oh, excuse me. Then in the external Josephson effect, I think it's a very amusing question, which some of us are in a banner are looking at. How does the hyperfine degree of freedom affect the honest-to-goodness external Josephson effect, by which I mean tunneling between, tunneling in a real spatial and a real potential? For example, suppose I start off with all my spins polarized up, and I then just manage to flip these spins over, say, by a certain angle. What then happens? I would love to think you get a precession, but there's a certain amount of argument in the Urbana group right now about whether that's true or not, or whether it's the most general thing that you can get. And finally, there's one very amusing thing, I think, which is perhaps really does make the phenomenon of superfluidity in this system different from what it is in helium-4. Namely, I believe that at least in principle, the hyperfine degree of freedom makes a total qualitative difference to the phenomenon of superflow. Some of the arguments which are used for the stability of superflow in helium-4 actually break down the moment you have an internal degree of freedom. And this, I think, should be very amusing to look at experimentally if it can be done. I don't see why it shouldn't. Okay, lithium-6 and other fermion systems, that's a whole subject in itself, so we probably shouldn't talk about that. And finally, a few pipe dreams. What I call the Kibble experiment, take three, and I know James and Ignacio and others have been thinking about this. Take three wells, make a Bose condensate in each of them separately. Then take down the three barriers simultaneously to the point where you have Josephson contact between them, and ask, do you ever, and if so how often, get a vortex formed like that? That's sort of, as I say, that's related to the Kibble mechanism in cosmology. I think in some ways it complements the neutron experiments, which have certain aspects which worry me. At least one of them, one experiment has a certain aspect which worries me. And it'd be interesting to see what does happen in that situation. And finally, something even more fascinating, I think, double superflow. We've always, essentially always up to now, assumed that you have a single condensate. Could you, in fact, create a double condensate? That is, not merely get n particles condensed into a linear superposition of two states, which is something we do all the time in some sense, rather have half the particles, n over 2, condensed into one state, and n over 2 condensed into a radically different state. Here's one very speculative proposal as to how you might do that. Let me do it in the context of helium-4, but it's obvious how it's generalized. Take a cylinder of helium-4, a cylinder such that I can rotate the bottom and top halves independently. And I will rotate the top half slowly and keep the bottom half stationary and cool down through the, initially having a partition between them, cool it down through the landing point. At that point, it's obvious what happens. The bottom half has zero superflow, the upper half has a certain finite superflow, but since they're not in contact, it doesn't matter. Okay? Now, what happens if I remove the partition? Is this state in fact highly unstable? Does it immediately start to decay into something much more boring? Or can you actually create a state in which you have more than one macroscopically occupied state? I think, for obvious reasons, that kind of experiment is going to be much less difficult. I won't say much easier, but certainly much less difficult to do for the alkali gases than it would be for helium. So that's certainly one of the things I personally would like to spend a bit of time thinking about. Well, as I say, I better stop because otherwise we're going to get invaded. But I'd be very, very much welcome in any comments that people have on any of this. And I'm sure we'll get them informally throughout the next week or two.
One comment just on your last one. What if one took an ordinary superconducting ring
and
got a flux point? Let's imagine we get some current flowing in it.
Yeah.
And then we brought another piece of superconductor simply within Josephson contact of it.
Yes, yes.
That reminds me at least a little bit of what you said. Yes. We condensed one into the momentum state and the other into a...
Yes, indeed. But I think what is that would itself be interesting. But I think in some sense this is a much stronger, more strongly interacting configuration, in that they could be mutually interpenetrating if they don't dislike it too much.
In what sense is this the possibility of having two different condensates? In what sense would that be different from a sophisticated version of the Josephson effect?
Well, I mean, in the there's a bit of technicality in the Josephson. The sort of situation, the circumstance under which the Josephson effect is normally discussed in superconductors of liquid helium, what you assume is that you indeed have n particles. If we talk about helium, say, wave function is clearly that form. Now, as you and I very well know, there are cases where that's not the right description, and where you might get psi 1 to the n over 2, psi 2 to the n over 2. But in that case, at least in this sort of spatially separated Josephson, they're not actually interpenetrating. I mean, you've got two spatially separated condensates. What's nice about this one is that they might actually be mutually interpenetrating. Now, I say it may be highly unstable. I rather suspect it is, actually, but at least it'd be worth thinking about, I think.
Actually, the experiment at Silla, they do this thing, but it's two internal levels. So how
That's right, and I think it's an interesting question about the Joule experiment. Did were they really in a Fox state or a coherent state or somewhere in between? My guess is that they were in a Fock-like state in that situation because they didn't have a laser on, right? I mean, they didn't. On the other hand, you might argue that enough fluctuations around. Remember that the phase fixing terms always win in the thermodynamic limit. That's a sort of generic statement. Even rather small phase fixing terms would have been enough to convert that into a.
So you would like a combination of n half plus 1, n half minus 1, n half sharp?
Well, I'd like to have a macroscopic number in it. Yeah, a macroscopic number in the two. I mean, I think it's certainly interesting to consider that situation. It's even more interesting when the actual spatial behavior is different in the two cases. Yeah. Okay, well, thank you for your patience.
I think we were talking about the